a lesson of firm. Is that great events take place in the world. But for reasons that we have a hard time perceiving. We see, as we study the history of the world, the big broad policy sweeps, the philosophical ideas that captured an age and defined the political ferment in the world, the political direction in the world. And yet the Megillah reminds us that so much of what takes place because of very personal agendas, very far removed from policy considerations. The role of the individual, the role of particular relationships and cosmic events. And perhaps that part of the insight of Lev Melocha Mesorim B'Yad Hashem, that the personal involvement colors so much of what takes place. The story of the Megillah, if we look from the Jewish standpoint, is the story of two great people. Mordechai Yehudi was one of the leading lights of the Sanhedrin, right? In Tanakh, the top of the Sanhedrin, a Godel. And Esther Amalka. Esther, the Gemara says in Megillah, is one of the Zion Nevi'os, one of the seven women who are blessed with prophecy. So, when we look at that, we imagine these are great leaders of the Jewish people, with great commitment to the Jewish people and its ideals. And that's what allowed them, in fact, to assert themselves in such trying times. And the fate of the Jewish people was hung in the balance. They were ready to stand up and be counted and sacrifice everything for it. But yet, the story of the Megillah, ultimately, Chazal tell us that the one Nevi'im kiflayim ki yetzim Mitzrayim. Over a million Nevi'im in the history, more than 1,200,000 Nevi'im in the history of Klal Yisrael. And yet, we have only a very small number of them are recorded in Jewish history. And what's the reason for that? The reason for that is that Nevuah Shehutzrichu L'Doros, if there was a lesson to be learned for posterity, it's recorded. If it was of passing historical interest, but there's no larger lesson to be learned from it, it doesn't need to be recorded, even though in and of itself at its time it might have been significant. Now, if we ask ourselves from that standpoint, we have a pasuk in the Megillah which seems totally out of place. We read, we're introduced to Mordechai, Yishihudi, Yom Shushan Abir, Shmo Mordechai, and Yom Shemim, and Kishi, Yishimini. And it's important, his background is important because that's what enabled him to have the schus, as Chazal tell us, to be able to succeed. Then it goes on to tell us, Vahi Oymer Sadasa. You know? It's a footnote, you know, put in an appendix, maybe in the back of the book. Mordechai was a good guy. He had a first cousin. For some reason, as I always point out, the grade school teachers always tell us that he was the uncle of Esther, whereas the Pasuk says specifically, he Esther Bas Dodo, the daughter of his uncle, means his first cousin, as it's used in the modern Ivrit, Ben Dodo and Bat Dodo, meaning for meaning a first cousin. Very nice, he was a good guy. And then he adopted her. She ain't lo over aim because she was orphaned from her father and her mother. He raised her as a daughter. Very nice. So we now know Mordechai was a good guy. So if you want to know who Gdolei Yisrael are, they're not only people that play a role in great religious events and on the world stage, but their personal lives are very pristine too. Okay, very nice. But what is in the world does that have to do with the story of the Megillah? And it's interesting, the Ralbak, one of the Rishonim, dwells on this pasuk. He puts his finger on the significance of this pasuk in the larger story of the Megillah. And it's a very telling tale. As the events unfold in the Megillah, Mordechai, for reasons that perhaps we'll discuss later tonight, makes a very, very difficult decision. One, in fact, it's hard even to understand why he made. Esther tells them they have to persuade the king to act favorably towards the Jewish people. So she tells him, I need lonely crazy love all the men of their shloshim yom. He hasn't called me in a month. Meaning to say, I'm his wife. Sooner rather than later, I'm going to get called to come to the king. Now, to go immediately, I have to roll the dice on my life. And if I roll the dice and it doesn't come up on my number, so the king will kill me. So that's it. The last hope of the Jewish people goes down the tubes. So why be impetuous, she tells Mordechai, and push the matter. Sit back. You know, the decree, this is Chodesh Adar. There's a whole year, it's Chodesh Nisan. There's 11 months until this decree is going to take place. So this is a matter of days or weeks, it's going to be resolved. So what are we being impetuous for? And Mordechai comes back at her with blazing on all guns, a 12-gauge shotgun. And he tells her that if you don't act now, Reva Fatsoli Amad Liga Yehudim Mokum Acha, you'll disappear in the dustbin of history. A has-been who had a moment that they could have done something for the glory of the Jewish people, and you ducked, you were a coward. We'll have to come back to why Mordechai pushes her in this regard. A very strange decision. But the question is, the Ravak says, why did Esther listen then? She was a great woman in her own rights, and her calculating view seems a lot more plausible way to deal with the situation than what Mordechai did. Mordechai almost seems a little bit rash in what he did. So why'd she listen to him? She's upset. I heard what he said. Listen, I might get killed, number one. It'll be bad for me. It'll be bad for the Jewish people. So why don't I listen? It's the way he sees it. I see it differently. So why, in fact, did she listen to him? And here's what the Rabbah tells us, that cosmic events are rooted in very personal and private stories. Esther felt the immense love and concern that Mordechai had for her. Why? Because as an orphan young child, he took her in and he raised her. There was a debt that she could never repay. An appreciation, the Rabbah says, that knew no bounds. And because of that, she respected the fact that Mordechai was not being frivolous with her life. Mordechai was as protective of Esther as Esther would be of herself. And he showed when he had to put out for her protection, he was there. And that gave her the confidence to submit to his authority. He was, in fact, one of the leaders of the Sanhedrin. But as great as she was, an Aviya, and as great as he was, she would not have acceded to his authority if not for the personal relationship that existed between them. What he had done for her in her hour of need. So as I said, we look at sweeping policy decisions. But what did they turn on? And what did they pivot? Very personal considerations. very personal considerations. How does Esther succeed in convincing Ahasuerus to change his mind? And what did Mordechai want in this bold decision that he made? You know, history sometimes justifies decisions, but we need to understand the rational basis for making them in the first place. Success does not necessarily indicate the wisdom of a course of action. So what was in fact the wisdom of his course of action? And that again is a very personal dimension. Ahasuerus, as we read the beginning of the story, Ahasuerus was a usurper of the throne. That's the history. The throne was not his. He married the queen, and therefore he became important. Now, his claim to the throne was significantly undermined by the fact that he kills Vashti, a very foolhardy move. If his whole claim to fame is that she's the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, and now he's not married to her anymore, so what's his claim to the throne altogether? What legitimacy does he have? A very foolhardy move. Because of that, Ahasuerus suffers from paranoia. He lives in tremendous fear. What do we find? We have the plot of Bigsan Vaseresh. They investigate it. They put him to death. But what is Ahasuerus' perspective on that event? He doesn't view it as an isolated event. Later, when his advisors are reading the Divrei Hayomim, the history of the events that have taken place, so Ahasuerus is alarmed. That is it conceivable that someone has done something for me and I haven't paid them back? Now, what was his concern? He had a very practical concern. The practical concern was that if I don't pay off the people that helped me, who's going to put out the neck to help me next time? Right? This is a dangerous... Mordechai was involved in a dangerous move. If it went down the wrong way, so he would be the victim. Bigsan Vaseresh would have used their power to turn on him, and that's it. And he would have met his death. You know, you cross the mafia. If you succeed, that's fine. If you don't succeed, it costs you your life. So who's going to undertake next time to save Ahasuerus? This is what's on his mind. He's concerned. What's going to happen? Who's going to save me next time? This is what he lived with. He lived with a constant fear what's going to happen? Who's going to help me next time? Because plots were in the air. So he'd suffered from tremendous paranoia, and he exacerbated it in that situation. He put himself into that situation by murdering Vashti. So what did Esther do? She tells him that she wants to meet him and Haman. The Gemara tells us in Megillah, why did she invite Haman? So the Gemara gives six different reasons for it. And Eliyahu HaNavi says that all six reasons are true. She played a very, very shrewd and complicated game. Among the things that she did is that she wanted Ahasuerus to believe that Haman and her had something going between them. And therefore he would get angry and he would kill Haman and Esther. So she comes to the party the first day, and he asks her, what do you want? She doesn't answer. She says, come back tomorrow. Ahasuerus is jumping out of his skin. He knows how to read the tea leaves. There's something that's not exactly correct taking place. But what it is, he doesn't know. Who knows where it's coming from? And he discovers, much to his chagrin, that his life was once saved and he didn't pay off. That means there may be a lot of people out there that know what's going on, but their lips are sealed. They're not talking to him. So he's climbing the walls. So this was all part, this is what Mordechai wanted. Mordechai said, go to Ahasuerus. If you wait until he calls you, so he won't be alarmed. But the fact she crossed the threshold uninvited, now Ahasuerus said to himself, this is no silly woman. She understands what's involved here. That I have the, by the laws of Persia, I have the right to kill her instantly. So why did she come? So it must be a matter of importance that brought her here. But she's inscrutable. She says, come, I'm making a party today for you and Haman. She increases his anxiety. Haman's involved, what is going on between them. She comes to the party, and he asks her, what do you want? She says, come back tomorrow. She played games with him. She understood his position, his political position, and his personality. And that's what pushed Mordechai to make this decision. Mordechai knew, Chazal tell us, that when Esther said, Ahasuerus asked her, that she wanted to point to him. Her gut reaction was to point to him, that you're the one that signed off on this, you're behind all of this. So it was such an instinctive reaction that the Malach had to come and push her hand in a different direction, that she shouldn't point to Ahasuerus. So she, the likelihood of Ahasuerus changing his mind because he was appealed to, he hated the Jews as much as Haman did. The one difference between them being that he wanted to as much as possible to deny his involvement, to keep it behind closed doors. He wanted Haman to play the lead role. And later he slips out of it. He says, oh, you know, that's, he was really up to that, you know, take care of him. So Mordechai understood. He understood the political position of Ahasuerus, and he understood his personality. And therefore he told us that the only way that you're going to get to Ahasuerus is to get him so agitated that he'll do something rash. And he's a personality that does rash things. He killed his first wife, which was the height of lunacy. It put his entire throne in jeopardy, and he did it. No rational person that didn't lose himself would do such a thing. So what we need to do is to bring him into a state of extreme agitation. And hopefully from there something will happen where will achieve the end. That's the only rational explanation I can find for what Mordechai wanted. But again, the understanding of personality. Great events. The world changed. Haman is defeated. And based on what? Not on any policy consideration. Not on benevolence. Merely because of the idiosyncrasies of one personality. And Mordechai's ability to game it. This is what ultimately defeats Haman. And the world, as I said, is dependent. Great things take place because of individuals. And individuals that are driven by agendas, personal agendas. Sometimes great personal agendas. Haman, why does he attack the Jewish people? Very strange pasuk. A very strange pasuk. Haman asks, who is this Mordechai? Vayivez be'einam, the shloyach yob be'Mordechai levada. Yigidu lo was am Mordechai, because they told him the nation of the Jewish people. Vayivakesh homon lashman is called Yehudim Hashem b'chol machlus achashverosh am Mordechai. What is the simple meaning of this pasuk? It was Vayives Beinov, he was felt contempt, l'shtolach Yehudim Mordechai levar, ki Yigidu lo was am Mordechai. And then Vayivakesh homon lashman is called Yehudim. What is pasuk saying? I thought I understood the pasuk, and I believe that the Gro, the Vilna Goyen, also learns the same shot in this pasuk. Haman had enmity to Mordechai, because Mordechai didn't give him the honor that he wanted. But had to settle scores with him. Had to settle scores with him. He could have sent his henchmen to kill him. That's it, just arrest him and take him away. He was the prime minister. In a society like that, that would have been no problem at all to do such a thing. But Haman thinks about it for a moment, and he doesn't want to take that course of action. Why? Because then he will appear in the eyes of society to be using his office to settle personal scores. Haman wants to be a clean politician. He's there for the country. He's the prime minister. You know, he's not some petty mafioso, you know, that if you cross him, whatever, he sends his guys to slit your throat in the middle of the night. That's not the image that he wanted to project. He wants to project himself. He's an important politician, a statesman. So what does he do? Finds out that Mordechai is a Jew. The Jews, the Jews are despised. And he knows it will not be difficult to arouse Ahasuerus to take action against all the Jews. So he comes to Ahasuerus and he tells him, let's speak about Mordechai. He tells him, they're strange people, nobody likes them, they act strange. So they don't listen to the king. So what in the world does the king need such people in his empire? And they're spread out. It's not like you'll wipe out, you know, one part of the country and it'll be desolate. There are a few here, a few there, a few there. We can just wipe them off and society will go on. They're spread out. So he comes and he appeals to Ahasuerus. This is what's for the best interest of Persia. You know, this is a rabble that we have to eliminate from Persian society. What's his agenda? His agenda is not the Jewish people. His agenda is that he'll kill Mordechai. But now, he's not going to kill Mordechai as a mafia don. Now, this is a state issue. It's an issue of the state. And therefore, while he's settling it, well, Mordechai was one of those that, you know, state policy was to kill. So he got killed. But totally above the personal frame. Now, Haman, his desire for personal status and image was such that he killed millions of people. Why? To protect his honor. The goal was to kill one person. But to kill that one person would undermine his whole stand. Not a statesman.
So then what happened? A day later, he's ready to hang him from the tree.
This is part of the whole, he's the head of the Jewish community. This is all, you know, once there's a decree against the Jewish people, so then, okay, you can stop wherever you want. But this is not just, you know, between, it's not him and Mordechai anymore. It's a global issue. He's the head, so I guess you start with the head. Hang the head first. But this is an assault, not on Mordechai, it's an assault on the Jewish people. An entire personal agenda, the entire undertaking to annihilate the Jewish people was to settle a personal score.
And had he, Chas v'Shalom, taken care of Mordechai on day one, would he have then done anything different? Or he would have let it run its course anyway?
No, of course he would have let him. He would have killed him anyhow. He wouldn't want it
no,
to
no,
be.
No, no, after he killed Mordechai.
Yes, of course he would have.
Wanted to kill all the Jews anyway.
Because otherwise it's a personal vendetta. He doesn't want a personal vendetta. It's a great event in the world. The whole story of Purim turns on the image, the spin makers of Haman, what image is going to have in Persia. How is it going to look? What are the blogs going to say about him behind his back? A cutthroat or a statesman? What's the image of a statesman? He wants to be a holy man in their society. So again, driven by what? Personal agenda.
Similar situation when you have a
that's absolutely the, that is absolutely the prescription.
Is that the precursor of Gog and Magog today?
That is absolutely the prescription.
What, that we have to do tshuva?
Well, no, we have to do tshuva, that's true. But the question is, why? What means should we endeavor to save ourselves? When Rav Aaron Kotler wanted Morgenthau's help for Varatzolo, what did he tell Morgenthau? You're a Jew. That's a great policies of the world in America and his benevolence. No? Hands Morgenthau, you're a Jew. Where are you for the Jewish people? And the forcefulness of Rivaran's personality, hands Morgenthau knew what he had to do. And probably saved the lives of hundreds of thousands of people because of that. In the last year or so of the war. Hundreds of thousands of people were saved from what? From the personal connection, not from anything else. The personal issues play such a role. Will share with you a perspective that I came to. I came to it through something else. What I came to it through was not important for tonight. I came to it through a certain incident and a certain conversation that I had with the Rodem Godel. And I understood his perspective based on what I'll tell you now. The Megillah ends on a very strange note. A very strange note. So who's the hero? The hero is Mordechai. The heroine is Esther. Listen, she gave up a life. She stuck to be the queen of Persia for the rest of her life. Right? And she couldn't go back to Mordechai, so she's certainly the heroine. But the hero is Mordechai. What does the Megillah tell us in the last pasuk? V'rotzi l'rov echov. Most of the Jews liked him. So what do you mean most of the Jews liked him? He saved everybody's life. Most of the Jews liked him. Pirshim Amenu Mikta Sanhedrin. Some of his colleagues on the Sanhedrin came out against him. No. We'll have to see why that's the case. Why they come out against him. But beyond that, let's say it's okay, it's true. But this is the final word we have to say about Mordechai. The final sentence about Mordechai, you know. A man that saved the Jews. Imagine that we would have been Zoicha in 1939, that such a figure would have emerged and would have saved us from the imminent Holocaust. We'd write about him in Jewish history. We couldn't sing his praises enough. Saved 6 million Jews from certain death. We weren't Zeicha. See, here he came, and we were Zeicha. In this story, we were Zeicha, that we were saved. So, This is whatever. There were some people liked them, but in Kisvei HaKodesh, we're right. This is what the Rebbeinu Shel Olam wants us to record about Mordechai. Rotzei L'Rov Echad. He had opposition. Good, as the Tosas Yonder rather wryly notes in one place. You know, nobody's loved by everyone. Okay, fine. But that's the final word. That's what we want to say about Mordechai. That's his place in Jewish history. Footnote, you know, we'll have a whole doctoral thesis about who his adversaries were and why. You know, set up shot. Shot is like this, very simple. There is an enigma in this Megillah, a very great enigma. Mordechai was from the handful of the Gdolei Ador, from the top of the Sanhedrin. The five greatest Chachamim, the five greatest Rabbonim of the Dor. Why in the world did he become the Prime Minister of Persia? He had nothing else to do with himself. Imagine for a moment in our society, imagine that Rav Moshe Feinstein will close the Gemara and move and he becomes President of the country. Imagine that Zangez and Dovel Yosef tells Netanyahu, go home, I'm taking over as Rosh Hashanah. So we would say the following. Listen. Well, we would say the following. Listen. Politicians, we have tons of politicians. Gdolei Ador, we have only a few. You know, we can't squander the Gdolei Ador to be the head of the government. In fact, the Sanhedrin was very carefully kept aside. Apart, the Kohanim were kept by the dictates of Yaakov, you know, apart from the Melucha. The religion and the Melucha shouldn't mix together. Directly. Indirectly, yes, but not directly. So why in the world did Mordechai do such a thing? What drove him to do such a thing?
He was scared of a repeat. He was scared of a repeat performance.
Oh, so Mechaira, you're right. He had the same kasha that Yaakov Avinu had. Yaakov Avinu, after his sons wiped off Shechem, so he told them, Acharta Mosil Abisheni B'yosh V'yoretz, that you besmirched my name. The Canaanim are not going to stand this. What do you mean? This band of Jews comes and just wipes the city off and we're going to stand back. They're going to get band together and they're going to take revenge. What happened now? 75,000 Sayyidi Yisrael were killed. There are millions and millions of people in Persia. They're going to sit back and not avenge themselves? So Mordechai said there's only one solution to this problem. The solution is that I will become the Prime Minister. And therefore, from that position, I'll protect the Jews. I have no choice. But Mordechai understood one thing very well. That this is a very radical and difficult decision. And some of his chaverim, his colleagues on the Sanhedrin, are not going to agree with him that he was right. Inevitably, not everyone would agree. They would say, listen, you didn't have to be it yourself. For appointing some other Jew to be the Prime Minister, didn't need you. And Mordechai felt that there was a certain connection between him and Ahasuerus, and this would play best for the Jewish people. But he knew that this is not a decision that everyone would agree with. Now, if the Persian Jewish Times came out against him, well, Kapora, he wouldn't have worried about it. That wouldn't have bothered him. But who came out against him? Pirshim Amenu Mikza Sanhedrin. Some of the greatest Talmidei Chachamim in the Dor said he's wrong. That has a sting to it. That hurts. And he knew beforehand that this would happen. Inevitably, this would be the reaction. It's not something that tapped, caught him by surprise. He understood that the nature of this decision will inevitably bring forth a certain measure of opposition to him. And Mordechai did it anyhow. Pushed aside, there are no personal considerations. It's a person that was totally devoid of ego. If it served the Jewish people, then I will accept the slings and arrows of criticism and good grace. It was Alman Askin. That's what the Megillah is telling us. The Megillah is telling us that for Mordechai to have made this decision, he had to be a very special person. A person who was committed to one idea, and that's the service of the Jewish people. And whatever could assist the Jewish people, that's what's worthwhile. Whatever the price, the personal price he has to pay. So again, the story of the individual, the yochid, driven by a higher agenda, where the Avas Yisrael is of a different proportion, of a different realm. This is the role of Mordechai, all of this.
So why does the Megillah record that as the last point?
Because that was the greatness of Mordechai.
That he was willing to do it.
That he was willing to do it. He knew it before. This didn't catch him by surprise. He understood it, and he was willing to do it. That's his greatness. His greatness was...
Even though I'll pay the price.
I will pay the price. Didn't make a difference.
He didn't need the approval of the time.
No, he didn't listen. He was... This was a decision that he, most, first of all, most of the Sanhedrin supported him. But even if not, he wasn't in the Galut. It was not a decision, it's not a formal decision of the Sanhedrin. But the stature of a person that's willing to make such a decision, because it's the right thing to do, this is how Mordechai comes to this moment.
So the Baruch Shalom is agreeing with Mordechai by putting that at the
end.
The Baruch Shalom is agreeing with him.
Yes. The Baruch Shalom is underscoring. We have a similar notion we're going to have, not in this week's Parsha, but in next week's Parsha. Right? Next week's Parsha is Parsha Zohar. We're going to have it again in Parsha Zohar. There's a rather renowned Balaturim at the beginning of Parsha Tetzaveh. And there we read in Parsha Tetzaveh V'ata Tetzaveh Bnei Yisrael, from the rise of Moshe Rabbeinu until deep in Mishneh Torah, whatever, but throughout most of the Torah, it's inconceivable that Moshe Rabbeinu was not mentioned by name. And here, he's addressed, but always in the second person, never by name. And the Balaturim tells us the reason for this is that in Parsha Kisiso, at the time of the Ego, they said, M'cheini no misifru chosher kosofto. So, since he made such a statement, so the Rabbeinu Shalom said, okay, well, you'll be crossed out. I'm going to cross you out fully. You're going to get crossed out of the book, the holy book, the Chumash. So we take the Balaturim as a pejorative statement about Moshe Rabbeinu. He spoke in such a fashion, and the Rabbeinu Shalom slapped him on the wrist. I do not think that's the pshat in the Balaturim. I think the Balaturim means something very different. Moshe Rabbeinu, the Rabbeinu Shalom comes to Moshe Rabbeinu at the time of the Ego, and he tells him that I'll destroy the Jewish people, the Eschei Yisrael Goy Godol, and I'll make you, I'll found a new Jewish people. Forget Avraham Avinu and everything that came before. We're going to wipe that all off the map. We're going to start again. There's a new founding father, Moshe Rabbeinu. And the Jewish people will come forth from being the descendants of Moshe, not the descendants of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So what does Moshe Rabbeinu tell him? He has to forgive the Jewish people. And if you don't want to forgive them, Moshe Rabbeinu has one role in the world. And that's not the life and times of Moshe Rabbeinu. Forget that. It's unimportant. Moshe Rabbeinu, you can forget about him. Moshe Rabbeinu is one thing. Moshe Rabbeinu is the servant of the Jewish people. Rav Kook, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, signed in many the salutation on many of his letters. I'm so taken by it. You know, when he would sign the salutation, read the following: Eved la'am kodesh al admas hakodesh, the servant of the holy nation al admas hakodesh, on the holy land. Is Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, I am the Eved of Klal Yisrael. If there's a Klal Yisrael, then there's a Moshe Rabbeinu. If there is no Klal Yisrael, then I'm gone together with them. When you wipe them off the map, I'm also gone. I have no role apart from that of Klal Yisrael. That's my role in the world. And therefore, what the Balaturim is telling us is to the contrary. The Rabbeinu Shalom is paying homage to Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu was totally self-effacing. He said, if you don't forgive the Jewish people, then you can, then I'm gone too. There's no Moshe Rabbeinu. There's no me. There's no I. There's the Eved of Am Kodesh. That's my role. The same issue of Mordechai. There's nothing, there's no me. Not what's important for me. Not my role. What's important for the Jewish people. And we find this again later in the Torah too. In Parshas Vayeshlach. When the Sanhedrin is appointed, so Moshe Rabbeinu goes to the Rabbi Shlomo when he asks him to appoint the Sanhedrin. And then he says, Bim Ayin, and if not, Horgeni no Horeg, Vale Rebbe Rossi. Take my life, and I shouldn't suffer a terrible fate of bearing this burden alone. That's the simple meaning of the Pasuk. But if we ask ourselves, this is the way a truculent teenager talks to his parent. If you don't give me what I want, Horgeni no Horeg, that's it, you know, take my life, I'll jump into the river, you know, who needs to live? That's the way Moshe Rabbeinu talks to the Rabbi Shlomo. So the Sforno tells us Moshe Rabbeinu meant something else. And he says, well, so I'm not going to mind him. Kocha at oisomi, that's the exact order of the passage. This is what you subject me to? Then Horgeni no Horeg. So the Sforno tells us, the meaning of this pasuk is that he understood in this fashion. Vim kochat oisa li, li means bishvili, because of me. Meaning to say, Moshe Rabbeinu said, it is self-evident that the Jewish people need such a large people more than just one person. We need a collective leadership. We can have a leader of the collective leadership, but there has to be a collective leadership which represents all the Shvatim and Klal Yisrael. Now, what conceivable reason would there be that you would not consent? There can only be one reason in the world, and that is you feel that it's degrading me, that I'm taking the leadership away from Moshe Rabbeinu, and I'm now creating a collective leadership. So you feel that it's degrading my honor. If that's the problem, so Moshe Rabbeinu says, I have a very elegant solution to the problem. Horgeni no Horeg. Take me from the world. I don't need to live. If my life is an impediment to the Jewish people, so I have the most elegant of solutions. So that's it, I'm ready to leave. Now, Vale Rebbe Rossi, this actually means Vale Rebbe Rossi. I should not see the suffering of the Jewish people, not my own problem. But Moshe Rabbeinu did not want to say that the Jewish people should suffer, so he talked to them in terms of himself. But he actually meant Vale Rebbe Rossi. So again, we find with Moshe Rabbeinu this aspect, that the agenda of the Jewish people, that's what it's about. So, that's a major lesson of the Megillah, that there were cosmic events in the world, but they take place because of very personal and private stories of individuals. And those are the things which create the great policy decisions of the world. And that's, I think, a perspective that we have to understand, that so often in dealing with issues, great issues and even small issues, is the question of the individual. How to deal with the individual that stands at the point of power, the point of decision making. And it's oftentimes not a great policy statement that sweeps today. It's something very personal, very visceral, which formulates that which will ultimately take place and color, in fact, the events of that moment and color the events of centuries to come. So, just look at the Megillah is to understand the human dynamics that were involved in making the events happen. The paranoia of Ahasuerus, the seeking of honor, the egoism of Haman, the respect that Esther had for Mordechai and allowing her to put her life in danger, and Mordechai's private notions of what Avos Yisrael meant, were very personal things. But ultimately, the story swings upon these personalities and these events. Good night, Gogolis.